Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks, The Learning College. Today we're going to do a new chapter from The Unabridged, The International Jew by Henry Ford. You know the background if you've been listening to the material we put up at vnnforum.com from this four-volume set of 80 chapters. This would be, I believe, chapter 25. Is that correct? It is correct. As we move further into the second volume there, I don't know that the volume has any particular meaning. Volume 1 was the international. Okay, it does. Volume 1 was the international Jew. And the books as a whole are called The International Jew, The World's Foremost Problem. Volume 2 is Jewish Activities in the United States. And last time we heard about Jews concealing their strength. Are Jews a nation? And then we heard a lot about Jews in finance and the Wall Street and their attempt to take over Wall Street. So now we're going to hear about, in chapter 25 and 26, which we'll do as one, Disraeli of America, a Jew of superpower, and then the scope of Jewish dictatorship in the U.S. So let's get into it. Disraeli of America, a Jew of superpower, and there's no epigraph in this chapter 25. Although the war had the effect of decreasing Jewish power in Wall Street by temporarily hindering, but perhaps not altogether breaking off, and again, this is written in 1920, right after the war, the communication between Jewish financial houses in the United States and their associates overseas, it also had the effect of greatly increasing Jewish wealth in this country. It is stated upon the authority of a well-informed Jewish source that in New York City alone, fully 73% of the war millionaires are Jews. The mistake should not be made of assuming that because of the temporary setback in Wall Street, the war meant a total setback for the Jewish program. It did not. Jewry emerged from the war more strongly entrenched in power, even in the U.S., than it was before, and in the world at large, the ascendancy of the Jew, even where he was in control before, is very marked. A Jew is now president of the League of Nations. A Zionist is the president of the Council of the League of Nations. A Jew is the president of France. A Jew was president of the committee to investigate the responsibility for the war, and one incident of his service was the disappearance of vital documents. In France, Germany, and England, the financial power of the Jews, as well as the filtration of their dangerous ideas of social disorder, have greatly increased. Let me repeat that last bit in case I didn't finish that off. In France, Germany, and England, the financial power of the Jews, as well as the filtration of their dangerous ideas of social disorder, have greatly increased. So Jew power grew greatly as of World War I, after World War I, heading the League of Nations, the council within the League of Nations, president of France, I think that was Leon Blum, making papers disappear, spreading social disorder, Marxism, in Russia, but not just in Russia, in Eastern Europe, in Central Europe, and even in England too. Worldwide, in fact. It is a most remarkable fact that in those countries which can justly be called anti-Semitic, the rule of the Jew is stronger than anywhere else. The more they are opposed, the more they show their power. Germany is today an anti-Semitic nation. Yet in spite of all the German people have done to rid themselves of the visible show of Jewish power, it has entrenched itself more firmly than before, above and beyond the reach of the German popular will. France becomes increasingly anti-Semitic, and as the anti-Jewish wave rises, a Jewish president appears. Russia itself is anti-Semitic to the core, and the Jew is Russia's new tyrant. And at a moment when, as all Jewish spokesmen inform us, there is a world wave of anti-Semitism, which is their name for a new awakening of the nations to what has been going on, what should occur but that the head of the League of Nations, in a position which, but for the absence of the United States, would constitute the chief magistracy of the world, a Jew appears. And I recall from history, class of Pomona taught by a Jew who was a guy from Brooklyn. He was into basketball. He was like an assistant coach to Popovich, a coach of the Spurs when he was there, I believe, or at least helped them. But he was an expert on Olaf Palme. But he said, I remember that there was more sentiment against Jews by far in France and Poland than there was in Germany at that time. can't remember the guy's name. I think he ended up being president of Scripps College. Stephen something, I'm thinking. He's actually, although a Jew and to some extent a leftist, he was a pretty good history teacher. But and he was the one who also, I probably have said this before, he said Hitler progressively discriminated against Jews. Now, we never talked about Holocaust type garbage or any of that stuff, but he talked about kind of the laws, said progressively made it more difficult for Jews to do business within Germany, and eventually most of them emigrated. So that's even a Jew admitting that. Whereas the average person thinks Hitler came to power and they were immediately rounded up and stuck in camps and killed off. No, most of them got out either before Hitler took power or in that period before the war from 33 to 38. Pardon me, I got a bit of a cold here. But anyway, so Jews consolidated their strength after World War I, and if it wasn't visible, they were thrown out of some of the offices in one nation, Germany. Yet they had seized power in Russia, and they were still even more powerful behind the scenes, as he says, above and beyond, in Germany itself. And there was great anti-Jew sentiment in France, yet it had a Jew president, and also in Poland. Nobody seems to know why. Nobody can explain it. Neither previous fitness nor public demand pointed him out, yet there he is. In our own country, we have just had a 4-year term of Jewish rule, almost as absolute as that which exists in Russia. Isn't that amazing? Like 1916 to 20, the wartime. This appears to be a very strong statement, but it is somewhat milder than the facts warrant. That is amazing. And the facts themselves are not of hearsay origin, nor the product of a biased point of view. They are the fruits of an inquiry by the lawful officials of the United States who were set aside in favor of a ready-made Jewish government, and they are forever spread upon the official records of the United States. The Jews have proved for all time that the control of Wall Street is not necessary to the control of the American people, and the person by whom they proved this was a Wall Street Jew. This man has been called the proconsul of Judah in America. It is said that once, referring to himself, he exclaimed, "Behold the Disraeli of the United States." To a select committee of the Congress of the United States, he said, quote, "I probably had more power than perhaps any other man did in the war. Doubtless that is true." And in saying so, he did not overstate the case. He did have more power. It was not all legal power, this much he admitted. It reached into every home and store and factory and bank and railway and mine. It touched armies and governments. It touched the recruiting boards. It made and unmade men without a word. It was power without responsibility and without limit. It was such a power as compelled the Gentile population to lay bare every secret before this man and his Jewish associates, giving them a knowledge and an advantage that billions of gold could not buy. Doubtless, not one in every 50,000 of the readers of this paper ever heard of the man before 1917, and doubtless the same number have clear knowledge of him now. He glided out of a certain obscurity, unlighted by the public service of fame, into the high rulership of the nation at war. The constituted government had little to do with him, save vote him the money and do his bidding. He said that men could have appealed over his head to the President of the United States, but, knowing the situation, men never did. Who is this figure, colossal in his way, and most instructive of the readiness of Judah to take the rule whenever he desires? His name is Bernard M. Baruch. Baruch. He was born in South Carolina 50 years ago, the son of Dr. Simon Baruch, who was a medical man of some consequence. Quote, "I went to college with the idea of becoming a doctor, but I did not become a doctor," he told a congressional committee. He was graduated at the CCNY College of the City of New York when he was just under 19 years of age. This college is one of the favorite educational institutions with the Jews, its president being Dr. S. E. Mezes, M-E-Z-E-S, a brother-in-law of Colonel E. M. House, the colonel whose influence and disfavor at the White House has for a long time been a favorite subject of wondering speculation on the part of the American people, though it scarcely need be so any longer. Apparently, young Baruch knew exactly what he wanted to do and set out to do it. He says he spent many years after graduation in certain studies, particularly economics, as related to railroads and industrial propositions. Quote, I tried to make Poor's Manual and the Financial Supplement of the Financial Chronicle my Bible for a number of years. He could not have spent very many years in these pursuits, for after going down to Wall Street as a clerk and a runner, and when he was, quote, about 26 or 27, unquote, he became a member of the firm of A.A. Houseman and Company, Housman. Quote, in about 1900 or 1902, unquote, he left the firm, but he had meanwhile gained a seat on the stock exchange. He then went into business for himself, a statement that must be taken literally in view of his testimony that, quote, he did not do any business for anybody but himself. I made a study of the corporations engaged in the production and manufacture of different things, and a study of the men engaged in them. In answer to the question intended to disclose the exact nature of his operations before he suddenly appeared as the man who, quote, had more power than perhaps any other man did in the war, he stood off from any intimations that he had perhaps engaged in mere buying and selling of stock. Quote, my business then became the organization of various enterprises, he said, quote, and in connection with that, I, of course, did buy and sell stocks. If I organized any concern, I naturally took a large interest in it, or I would not organize it if I did not believe in it, and I stayed with the development of that concern, and then if I cared later on to sell it, I would sell it. Pressed by the examiners for a still more detailed account of his activities in business, he said, well, I was instrumental in the purchase of the Liggett and Myers Tobacco Company, in the purchase of Selby Smelter, Tacoma Smelter, and various copper, tungsten, rubber. I was instrumental in building up one of the great industries in rubber in Mexico, which was the establishment of the source of supply of rubber, and developed a large concern there for the production of raw material, which is still going on. More quote. I became interested in the new process of concentration of low-grade ores in the Mesaba Range, but the interest I had particularly in steel was in the study of the present-day organization in order to get myself posted so that I could intelligently buy or sell their securities. Notice the Jew pays great attention to detail and immerses himself in the study of various things in order to command and control it or to profit from it by speculating on it. This is who we contend with as Team White versus Team Jew. It is an important point, one not made very clear in the testimony. What interest Mr. Baruch held at the beginning of the war? Or what interests Mr. Baruch held at the beginning of the war? His previous activities in various fields, principally perhaps in the field of metals, had been important and numerous. In any case, as a young man, he is found to be master of large sums of money, and there is no indication that he inherited it. He is very wealthy. What change the war made in his wealth, if it made any change at all, is a matter on which nothing may be said now. Certainly many of his friends and closest associates reaped great quantities of money from their activities during the war. Now, as to the point of his business connections just prior to the war, this testimony appears. Mr. Graham, you continued in the operation of these various businesses, in the formation of companies and the flotation of their stocks, and in your business in the stock exchange and elsewhere, up until the time of the beginning of the war? Mr. Baruch, I was gradually getting myself away from business because I had made up my mind to retire, and I had been getting less active with that end in view, and I was not very much in sympathy with the organization of companies. I am not criticizing other men who engage in business that resulted in profits even before we had gotten into war. I had made up my mind to leave and to do some other things that I hope to be able to do now, but that process was interrupted by my appointment as a member of the Advisory Commission, without any suggestion or without any knowledge or idea that it was coming. Does he mean that the process of getting out of business was interrupted by his appointment on the Advisory Commission, which appointment led straight to his complete rulership of the United States at war? Mr. Jefferies, and again, this is Ford interjecting amidst testimony from Mr. Jefferies, or Jefferies, had any of the members of the Advisory Commission been engaged in the production of raw materials or in manufactured products or not? Mr. Baruch, I had. Mr. Jefferies, in what way? Mr. Baruch, I had made a rather deep study of the production and the distribution and manufacture of many of these raw materials. I had to make an intensive study of these things in order to do the things I was engaged in. Mr. Jafaris, you were not running any raw material production. Mr. Brook, I was interested in concerns. I was interested in the study and production of a great many of these things because I developed and organized concerns which did it. So he's setting up these things that he's not directly himself doing it, but he's creating great industrial concerns that handle the processing of raw materials. Does he mean that he was interested in concerns at the time of his appointment? This would be an interesting point to clear up. Another matter that would be not only of great interest, but of great usefulness in explaining the gathering of a Jewish government around the president during the war, Wilson, is the question of Bernard M. Baruch's acquaintance with Woodrow Wilson. When did it begin? What circumstances or what persons brought them together? There are stories, of course, and one of them may be true, but the story ought not to be told unless accompanied by the fullest confirmation. Why should it occur that a Jew should be the one man ready and selected for a position of great power during the war? Mr. Baruch, in his testimony, sheds no light on this question. He had an opportunity to do so, had he wished. Mr. Graham, I assume that you were personally acquainted with the president prior to the outbreak of the war. Mr. Baruch, yes, sir. Mr. Graham, up to that time, up to the time you were appointed as a member of the advisory commission, had you ever had any personal conferences with the president about these matters? Mr. Baruch, yes, sir. Mr. Graham, had he called you in consultation or had he talked to you about these matters and about the matter of your appointment before you were appointed? Mr. Baruch, never suggested anything about the appointment because I would have told him that I would prefer not to be appointed. Mr. Graham, do you now recall, Mr. Baruch, how long before you were actually appointed as a member of that advisory commission you had your last conference with the president? Mr. Baruch, no. So he doesn't remember how soon before he was appointed he last talked with the President Wilson. So it's unclear the relation here between Wilson and Baruch, and he's not exactly clarifying it himself. That no is not all of Mr. Baruch's answer, but it is his reply to the question. Having said no, Mr. Baruch became very communicative in another matter. His complete reply is, no, but I can tell you something that may be of interest, and that is probably what you want to know. I had been very much disturbed by the unprepared condition of this country, so much so that I was one of the first men to support General Wood in the Plattsburgh encampment, and I think he will admit I gave him the first money and told him whatever he did, I would guarantee to stand behind that movement, which happily only took a few $1,000s so far as I was concerned, having caught the public approval, and it went ahead, and in that relation, naturally, one had to think about the mobilization of the industries of the country, because people do not fight alone with their hands, they have got to fight with things. Says Ford, it is thus shown that Mr. Baruch was a four-handed gentleman. It was only the year 1915. The European War had not then become more than an amazing spectacle to the mass of the American people. But still Mr. Baruch was convinced that we were going to have war, and he spent money on his guess. The government, which was then, quote, keeping us out of the war, was also consulting with Mr. Baruch, who was already ahead of the government in creating the atmosphere of war in this country. If the reader, by a mental effort, can reconstruct the year of 1915, and then put into his picture of that year the element of which he was not then possessed, that means not aware of, namely the activity of Mr. Bernard M. Baruch and other Jews, he will see that he did not know much about what was going on, even if he did read the newspapers with attention. So the newspapers are, people are running for office and the slogan of he kept us out of war, while meanwhile the Jews are maneuvering behind the scenes to get us into war and getting our armaments industry prepared for it. And our industrial concerns prepared for it and are even funding it. To proceed with the examination following the place where Mr. Baruch made his interesting disclosure on his part in the Plattsburgh experiment, Mr. Graham, that was about 1915, was it not? Mr. Baruch, yes, 1915, and I had been thinking about it very seriously, and I thought we would be drawn into the war. I went off on a long trip, and it was while on this trip that I felt there ought to be some mobilization of the industries, and I was thinking about the scheme that practically was put into effect and was working when I was chairman of the board. When I came back from the trip, I asked for an interview with the president. It was the first time I had seen the president since his election, so far as I can remember now. You mean his first election? His first election, yes. So it is probable that Mr. Baruch, if any stress may be placed on the manner of his words, had known the president before. Ordinary men who meet the president seldom usually have a very clear recollection of those meetings. The fact probably is that Mr. Baruch saw the president so frequently that he found it difficult to distinguish the meetings in his memory. He describes the visit referred to, quote, "I explained to him as earnestly as I could that I was very deeply concerned about the necessity of the mobilization of the industries of the country. The president listened very attentively and graciously, as he always does. And the next thing I heard, some months afterward, my attention was brought to this Council of National Defense. Secretary Baker brought it to my attention. This was the first time I had met the Secretary of War. He asked me what I thought of it." Mr. Graham, that was before the bill was passed, before it became a law. Mr. Brooke, I think it was. I am not certain about that. I said I would like to have something different. This, says Ford, is rather important. A council is a council. Mr. Baruch wanted something different. Eventually, he did get something different. He got the president so to change matters as to make Mr. Baruch the most powerful man in the war. The Council of National Defense eventually became the merest sideshow. It was not a council of Americans that ran the war. It was an autocracy, dictatorship, headed by a Jew, with Jews at every strategic point down the line. What Mr. Baruch did was very masterly, but it was not in the American manner. He did what he set out to do, but it is seriously to be questioned whether any man ought to have done what he did, and probably no one but a member of his race would have wanted to do it. Mr. Graham, did the president express any opinion about the advisability of adopting the scheme you proposed? Mr. Baruch, I think I did most of the talking. I do not remember what the president said on that subject, but I think it can be best seen as expressed in the bill. Mr. Graham, did you impress him with your belief that we were going to get into the war? Mr. Baruch, I probably did. I would like to tell you exactly, but I do not want to guess at it. Mr. Graham, that was your opinion at the time. Mr. Baruch, yes, I thought we were going to get into the war. I thought a war was coming long before it did. The examination then reverted to Mr. Baruch's conference with the Secretary of War, in which the former had said he, quote, would like to have something different. Mr. Graham, Mr. Baker said he thought that was the best thing that could be gotten at that time. Mr. Baruch, I got that impression. Whether he said so or not, I do not know, but I got that impression that that was the best that could be gotten at that time. If the event had not turned out exactly as Mr. Baruch planned it, a great deal of his testimony might be discounted on the principle of the natural boastfulness of the Jew after a scheme has succeeded. But there is no discounting anything that he says. The president did exactly what Baruch wanted in a thousand manners, and what Baruch apparently wanted most of all was a ruling hand upon productive America. And that he got. He got it in a larger measure than even Lenin ever got in Russia, for here in the U.S., the people saw nothing but the patriotic element. They did not see the Jewish government looming above them, yet there it was. The Council of National Defense, as originally constituted, quote, the best that could be gotten at that time, though Mr. Baruch, quote, would like something different, was headed by six secretaries of the cabinet, the secretaries of War, Navy, Interior, Agriculture, Commerce, and Labor. Beneath this official group was an advisory commission of seven men, three of whom were Jews. One of these Jews was Mr. Baruch. Beneath this advisory commission were scores and hundreds of men and many committees. One of the groups subordinate to the two groups just mentioned was the War Industries Board, of which Mr. Baruch was originally merely a member, Daniel Willard being the chairman. Now, it was this War Industries Board which became the, quote, whole thing later on, and it was Mr. Baruch who became the whole thing in that board. So you've got a Council of National Defense, you've got the heads of the cabinets, and then below that you've got an advisory commission, and chief thing there is the War Production Board, and the head of that is this Jew, Baruch, and he basically is functioning as a dictator with more power than Lenin over the entire American productive economy. That's what Ford is saying. The place where he was put became the cornerstone. He became the chief pillar of the war administration. The records show it. He himself admits it. What influence reached into this council of the hundreds of Americans and chose a single Jew to be their undoubted lord and master for the duration of the war? Was it Baruch's brains that elevated him? Or was it the suggestion of Jewish finance already well put forward in its work of mobilization? There is no desire to minimize the Baruch brain. Brains and money are the Jews' brains and money are the Jews' two greatest weapons. No Jew is picked for a place who has not brains. Baruch has brains. He is a ceaseless wonder among men who know him. He can do six things at once and control the most colossal operations without fuss or fever. He has both brains and money. But there is something for Jewry to learn. Brains and money are not enough. There is another element that even brains cannot cope with and which renders money cheap. The chess-playing expert may mystify and compel admiration, but the chess player does not rule the world. So, Baruch did things. But Trotsky has also done things. The point is this. Are people to be carried away by an appeal deliberately made to their imagination? Or are they to scrutinize what has been done and weigh its consequences? The Jews could do greater things in the United States than even Baruch has done, but if the opportunity offered acts of superb ease and mastery, but what would it signify? The ideal of a dictator of the U.S. has never been absent from the group in which Baruch is found. Witness the work of Philip Drew, administrator, commonly attributed to Colonel E.M. House and never denied by him. That was I think that was about a global government, and this guy was, this is the world that they're trying to build, and it's not simply the Jews who want a one-world government, but it was also Cecil Rhodes and the WASP's idea of a global world that was somewhat different from the Jews, but in many ways overlapping and dovetailing. As a matter of fact, Baruch could probably do a better job than Trotsky did. Certainly the recent experience which he had in governing the country during the war was very valuable education in the art of autocracy. Not that it is by any means Mr. Baruch's possession alone, it is also the possession of scores of Jewish leaders who flitted about from department to department, from field to field, receiving a postgraduate course in the art of autocracy, not to mention other things. And remember that they said, and when we were in those chapters of this recording, when we were talking about the protocols, they raise up some of their kind from youth to train them as administrators of matters global political. And then this would be their finishing school. Well, here you get to actually work on the War Production Board and run the biggest economy in the world, or the one of the top five at that time. I don't know if the U.S. was quite number one at that point. I don't think that it was, but it must have been getting there. Anyway, so before Bernard M. Baruch got through, he was the head and center of a system of control such as the United States government itself never possessed and never will possess until it changes its character as a free government, which basically was happening in the 5 years before this was written with the tax and the creation of the Federal Reserve, which was kind of the enabling act. And then in the 15 years after, under FDR, it's going to create all the alphabet soup agencies and turn us into another standard socialist social democracy, like you see in Europe, instead of a free country where people basically are left alone and they don't have to fund the government and every bad thing the government wants to do, and the government does almost nothing but bad things out of their own earnings, i.e. they're enslaved by it. So when he says, and this is not the first time we've seen this, it's about the 15th time, he's spitting in the wind when he says the Baruch was head and center of a system of control such as the U.S. government never possessed and never will possess again until it changes its character. Well, it was undergoing that change at the very moment he's writing this. And then he has more quotes from a transcript as we draw to the end of this chapter. Mr. Jafaris, in other words, you determined what everybody could have. Mr. Brook, exactly. There is no question about that. I assume that responsibility, sir, and that final determination rested with me. Mr. Jeffress, what? That final determination, as the President said, rested with me. The determination of whether the Army or Navy should have it rested with me. The determination of whether the Railroad Administration could have it, or the Allies, or whether General Allenby should have locomotives, or whether they should be used in Russia or used in France. Mr. Jeffress, you had considerable power. Indeed I did, sir. Mr. Jeffress, and all those different lines really ultimately centered in you, so far as power was concerned. Mr. Baruch, Jew Baruch. Yes, sir, it did. I probably had more power than perhaps any other man did in the war. Doubtless that is true. What preceded Mr. Baruch's attainment of this power, how far his power is reached, and how it was used will be our next inquiry. So, this was published 27 November 1920, and then we move immediately into that question in the next chapter, chapter 26, the scope of Jewish dictatorship in the U.S. Chapter 26 begins with an epigraph, as most of them do, from the Protocols, as many of them to most of them are. The King of Israel must not be influenced by his passions, especially by sensuality. No particular element of his nature must have the upper hand and rule over his mind. Sensuality, more than anything else, upsets mental ability and clearness of vision by deflecting thought to the worst and most bestial side of human nature. And you know, that's precisely why the Jews promote loose sex. Because it cloudies, it muddies thinking. It obscures reality and gets people focused on following their lusts rather than seeing what the Jews are doing to society. To close that quote, the pillar of the universe in the person of the world ruler, sprung from the seed of David, must sacrifice all personal desires for the benefit of his people. Protocol 24. Then we get into the chapter, which is again a continuation of last one. We're looking at Baruch and the hearings, and title is The Scope of Jewish Dictatorship in the U.S. Again, this is written 95 years from when I'm reading this in 2015, back in 1920, at the end of that year, just about exactly. It's November now, and this was about exactly 95 years ago. The common criticism made against President Wilson that, quote, he played a lone hand and would not avail himself of advice, can be made only by those who are in ignorance of the Jewish government, which continually advised the president on all matters. Just when Bernard M. Baruch, the Jewish High Governor of the United States in war affairs, came to know Mr. Wilson, is yet to be told, but just when he got into and out of the war are matters about which he himself has told us. He got into the war at Plattsburgh 2 years before there was a war, and he got out of the war when business at Paris was ended. Quote, I came back on the George Washington, he testified, which means that he remained in Paris until the last detail was arranged. It is said that Mr. Baruch was normally a Republican until Woodrow Wilson began to loom up as a presidential possibility. The Jews made much of Woodrow Wilson, far too much for his own good. They formed a solid ring around him. There was a time when he communicated to the country through no one but a Jew. The best political writers of the country were sidetracked for 2 years because the president chose the Jewish journalist David Lawrence as his unofficial mouthpiece. Lawrence had the run of the White House offices with frequent access to the president, and for a time he was the high cockalorum of national newspaperdom, but neither that privilege nor the assiduous boosting of the Jewish ring availed to make him a favorite with the American public. American Jewry was democratic until it had secured the last favor that Woodrow Wilson could give, and then it left the Democratic Party, as with the indecent haste of rats leaving a sinking ship. Baruch stayed rather ostentatiously, spending his money for motion picture appeals in favor of the League of Nations, but it is entirely probable that he has a genuine interest in the new administration. For one thing, there may be investigations. It remains to be seen whether the investigations which the Republican majority in the House began to make with regard to war expenditures will be continued. There are those who profess to believe that they will not be continued. The explanation being that such investigation was made before election was solely for the purpose of securing campaign data or creating a political atmosphere unfavorable to the Democrats. It is sincerely to be hoped that the Republicans will not rest under that imputation, but that they will rigorously pursue the investigations that have been begun. There are two reasons why this should be done. First, that the country may know, with a full view to future contingencies, what was put over on the government during the war. Second, that the full sweep of Jewish influence in this country may be exposed. The second reason is not expected to appear very weighty to practical politicians, and that is no matter, for the first reason is deemed sufficient, and if the investigations are honestly made, then inevitably the Jewish power will be further exposed. It is linked up at every stage of the business. But again we see, and this is completely parallel to what Revelo Pialaver was saying about his experience in D.C. in the Second World War, you know, another 20 years down the line, is that he couldn't believe all the Jewish control and corruption that were going on, and he was just absolutely sure, because he was working in one of the intelligence branches, that when the war was over, there would be investigations into it, and the American people would be horrified and disgusted, and D.C. would be clean right out. So, like Ford, he's thinking that all we need to do is shed the light of day on this and expose it, and Americans will clean it up. But that's not what happened. It's not what happened. The Jews consolidated their control. Mere exposure is not enough. This may have something to do with the sudden desertion of the Democratic Party by the Jews. They may have swung over in order to have something to say about the pursuit of further investigations. Already the council is being heard. Let bygones be bygones. The people are tired of investigations and don't want any more. Already attempts are being made to introduce fresher issues to deflect the public mind from war affairs, and the attempts are doubtless Jewish in their origin. The portion of the public who are awake to the Jewish question will do well to observe with care the attitude of the new administration toward completing the investigations. The Jews did not flock to the Republicans for nothing. The country is entitled to know what was done with the fabulous amounts of money spent during the war. The people are entitled to know who were their masters and who were responsible for certain strange situations which were created. Members of the House, senators, and other officials should, at the very least, pay particular attention to the directions from which influences against further inquiry come. Now, as to Mr. Bernard M. Baruch, who for some as yet undefined reason was made head in front of the United States at war, we have his own word on several occasions that he was the most important man in the war. I probably had more power than perhaps any other man in the war. Doubtless that is true, he told Representative Jefferis. And again, we had the power of priority, which was the greatest power in the war. He could decide where the assets were allocated. Exactly, there is no question about that. I assume that responsibility, sir, and that final determination rested with me. And when Representative Jefferis said, "What?" to that startling statement, Mr. Baruch repeated it. That final determination, as the President said, rested with me. Or within me. Representative Graham said to him, "In other words, am I right about this, Mr. Baruch, that yours was the guiding mind?" And Mr. Baruch replied, "That is partly correct. I think you were entirely correct." Now, in what did Baruch's power consist? Briefly, in this, in the dictatorship of the United States. He once expressed the opinion that the U.S. could have been managed that way in time of peace, but he explained that it was easier in time of war, was made easy because of the patriotic mood of the people. It is not sufficient, however, to say that Mr. Baruch's rule constituted a dictatorship of the United States. It remains to be shown just how rigid and far-reaching that dictatorship was. The reader may recognize at what point Jewish rule touched his affairs also. So he's saying the Jews had their tentacles over everything. They were a complete dictatorship. He said that actually understates the situation. Mr. Baruch, who had the final determination, in quotes, of everything, says that his power extended to the needs of the Army and Navy, the Shipping Board, the Railroad Administration, touched also the Food and Fuel Administrations, and besides all that, had a vital control of the Allies' purchases, not only in the U.S., but also in other countries, with reference to certain materials. There were $30 billions spent by the U.S. government during the war, all of it raised by taxation and bonds. Of this sum, $10 billion was loaned to the Allies and spent here, all of the purchases being vised under Mr. Baruch's authority. As told by himself, his power consisted in the following authorities. 1. Authority over the use of capital in the private business of Americans. This authority was nominally under the Capital Issues Committee, the controlling factor of which was another Jew, Eugene Meyer, Jr. Here is another inexplicable circumstance. Was he the only banker in the U.S. capable of exercising a dominant influence? Why did it happen that a Jew should be found in this important position, too? Is it only accident? Was there no design involved? Well, it was necessary during the war for anyone wishing to use capital in business enterprise to lay all his cards on the table. He was required to reveal his plans, his ground for expecting success. In brief, tell the Jewish rulers and their Jewish representatives all that he would tell in confidence to his banker in negotiating a loan. Unbelievable. The organization which a few Jews preferred was the most complete business inquisition ever set up in any country, and that the knowledge thus gained should always be secretly guarded or always honestly used would be expecting too much of human nature. Mr. Baruch gave some instances of this, though they were not the instances that are calculated to throw the most light on the inner workings of the organization. He said, quote, "The Capital Issues Committee, where Mr. Meyer reigned, in the Treasury Department, had a man who sat with the War Industries Board, where Mr. Baruch reigned, and who always came to the War Industries Board to find out whether the individual or the corporation who wanted this money was going to use it for the purpose to win the war. To cite a case that happened at Philadelphia, that city wanted to make extensive public improvements. New York City wanted to spend $8 million for schools, which would take an enormous amount of steel, labor, materials, and transportation. We said, no, that won't help us win the war. You can postpone that until later on. We cannot spare the steel and all these various things. Very well. Does Mr. Baruch know of an enormous theater which a Jewish theatrical owner was permitted to build in an eastern city during the war? Did he ever hear of non-Jews being refused permission to go ahead in a legitimate business which would have helped produce war materials, and then afterward, on almost identically the same plans, and in the same locality, a Jewish concern was given permission to do that very thing? This was a terrible power, and far too great to be vested in one man. Certainly it was such a power as should never have been vested in a coterie of Jews. The puzzle of it becomes greater the deeper it is probed. How did it occur? How could it occur? That always, at the most critical and delicate points in these matters, there sat a Jew enthroned with autocratic power." Well could Mr. Baruch say, "I had more power than any man in the war." He could even have said, "We Jews had more power than you Americans did in the war," and it would have been true. Second power that he had, authority over all materials. This, of course, included everything. Mr. Baruch was an expert in many of these lines of material involved, as we heard last chapter, and had held interest in many of them. What the investigators endeavored to learn was in how many lines he was interested during the war. In lines where Mr. Baruch was not expert, he, of course, had experts in charge. There was Mr. Julius Rosenwald, another Jew, who was in charge of, quote, supplies, including clothing, and who had Mr. Eisenman to represent him. Mr. Eisenman was on the stand for a considerable period with regard to uniforms, the change made in their quality, the price paid to the manufacturers, mostly Jewish, and other interesting questions. The great Guggenheim copper interests, who sold most of the copper used during the war, were represented by a former employee, but undoubtedly Mr. Baruch himself, who was much interested in copper during his business career, was the principal expert in that line. It is impossible to escape the names of the Jews all down the line in these most important developments. But for the present, attention is called to the scope of Mr. Baruch's control in the country at large. It is best stated in his own words, quote, "No building costing more than $2,500 could be erected in the U.S. without approval of the War Industries Board. Nobody could get a barrel of cement without its approval. You could not get a piece of zinc for your kitchen table without the approval of the War Industries Board." That's pretty amazing. Third power, authority over industries. He determined where coal might be shipped, where steel might be sold, where industries might be operated, and where not. With control over capital needed in business, when also control of the materials needed in industry. This control over industry was exercised through the device called priorities, which Mr. Baruch rightly described as, quote, "the greatest power in the war." He was the most powerful man in the war because he exercised this power. Mr. Baruch said there were 351 or 357 lines of industry under his control in the U.S., including, quote, "practically every raw material in the world." "I had final authority," he said, "whether it was sugars or silk or coal or cannon. Mr. Baruch ruled its movements." Then we got a quote from the transcript, a block quote from the transcript of the questioning. Mr. Jafaris, "for instance, this priority that you had would decide whether civilians should have any commodities for building." Baruch, "yes, if we had not that priority committee, the civilians would have had nothing." "Did they get anything?" "They got all there was." "Did you sit with these priority boards at any time or not?" "Sometimes, not very frequently. I was ex officio of every one of the committees and made it my business to go around as far as I could and keep in touch with everything." "And all these different lines really ultimately centered in you, so far as power was concerned?" "Yes, sir, it did. I probably had more power than perhaps any other man in the war. Doubtless that is true." That, however, was not the full extent of Mr. Baruch's control over industry. The heart of industry is power. Mr. Baruch controlled the power of the United States. The dream of the power trust, an evil dream for this country, was realized for the first time under the organization which this single individual formed. He says, "Not only did we endeavor to control the raw materials, but as well the manufacturing facilities of the country. We established priority uses also for power." 4. Authority over the classes of men to be called to military service. Baruch virtually pointed out to the Provost Marshal of the United States, the classes of men to be taken into the army. "We had to decide, virtually, the necessity of such things," he said. "We decided that the less essential industries would have to be curbed, and it was from them that manpower would have to be taken for the army." In this way, he ruled chauffeurs, traveling salesmen, and similar classes into military service. It was, of course, necessary that some such ruling be made. But why one man? Why always this one man? 5. Authority over the personnel of labor in this country. "We decided upon a dilution of men with women labor, which was a thing that had always been fought by the labor unions." 6. "And now, behold, as complete an illustration of one part of the protocols as ever could be found in any Gentile government. Readers of the previous articles will remember the passage. Quote, "We will force up wages, which, however, will be of no benefit to the workers, for we will at the same time cause a rise in the prices of necessities." Mr. Baruch was at one time inclined to sidestep the matter of fixing wages. He did not like the expression. But that the reader himself may decide, we quote the testimony in full. Same two again, Jafaris and Baruch. I'll read them in just alternating voices. "Did the War Industries Board fix the price of labor? If you can call it that way, but I would not say so. No, sir. I'm trying to get at what you did. No, sir, we did not fix the price of wages. What did you do? Just what I told you. Probably I'm a little dense, but I did not catch it if you told me. Well, when the price-fixing committees fix the price of steel, we will say they said, this is the price agreed upon, and you shall keep wages where they are. And those were the wages that were prevailing at the price we fixed. At the time prices were fixed, at first they were very much higher than the prices that we fixed. Jafaris, when you got the price of any of these low materials, you would fix the price of labor that was to be employed in producing them, to the extent that it should remain at the maximum of what it was when we fixed the price. Considering the weight of Mr. Baruch's authority and the stipulations he made, this was all, to all intents and purposes, the fixing of the rate of wages. Now, as to the fixing of prices, Mr. Baruch is much more positive. In answer to a question by Mr. Garrett, Mr. Baruch said, "We fixed the prices in cooperation with the industries, but when we fixed a price, we fixed it for the total production, not alone for the Army and Navy, but for the Allies and the civilian population." The minutes of one of the meetings of Mr. Baruch's board show this. Quote, "Commissioner Baruch directed that the minutes show that the commission had consumed the entire afternoon in a discussion of price fixing, particularly with reference to the control of the food supply, grain, cotton, wool, and raw materials generally. Mr. Graham, tell me something else. How much personal attention did you give to the matter of price fixing?" Mr. Baruch, "In the beginning, considerable." At another time, Mr. Baruch said, "There was no law at all in the land to fix prices." "We grant that," says Mr. Jafaris, "but you did it." "Yes, we did it. And we did a great many other things in the stress of the times." Here was one man having supreme dictatorial power at both ends of the common people's affairs. He admits that of the 351 or 357 lines of essential industry which he controlled, he fixed the prices at which the commodities should be sold to the government and to civilians. In fixing the prices, however, he made wage stipulations. The matter of wages came first. It entered into Mr. Baruch's computation of the cost, on which, to a certain extent, he based the price. Then, having decided what the producer was to receive in wages, he decided next what the producer should pay for a living. The producer himself may answer the question as to how it all turned out! Exclamation point. Wages were high, but not quite so high as living. And the answer to both is in the testimony of Barney Baruch. That is not the whole story by any means. It is inserted here merely to find its place in the list of authorities conferred on Mr. Baruch, all these different powers. They're using the term authorities for them. How completely Baruch felt himself to be the power is shown by a passage which occurred when he was trying to explain the very large profits made by some concerns with which he did business. Jafaris, "Then the system which you did adopt did not give the Lucan Steel and Iron Company the amount of profit that the low-producing companies had." "No, but we took 80% away from the others." "The law did that, didn't it?" "Yes, the law did that." "What do you mean by the use of the word we?" "The government did that, excuse me, but I meant we, the Congress." "You meant that the Congress passed a law covering that?" "Yes, sir." "Did you have anything to do with that?" "Not a thing." "Then I would not use the word we if I were you," concludes Jafaris. "Whether," says Ford, "Mr. Baruch slipped up there, he best knows. Just as he had power to give the workers wages and take it away again by price fixing, so he had the power to allow the raw materials corporations to make fabulous profits, and it would not be at all unthinkable that he also had something to do with taking part of it away again. He once said, 'We took away 80%, then he confessed it was a slip. A slip of the tongue or of his prudence? Certainly the profits he allowed were so large that even when the 80% was paid back, where it was paid back, there were all kinds of evasions and frauds, the profits were still enormous. And as we said last chapter, 73% of the war millionaires of New York, war millionaires in quotes, in spite of the 80%, are Jews. That ends that chapter 26, which appeared the 4th of December 1920. So we see that the Jews completely dominated World War I politically in the U.S., and Baruch was the king of the Jews, and he ran basically the entire war effort, which was pretty much the sole concern of the government at that point. So remember, we didn't have all the health, education, welfare, and socialism that we have today. And this Jew is dictating prices and labor and who goes in the army and who doesn't and how capital can be expended and who gets materials. I mean, it's absolutely astonishing. Anyway, that will do it for this segment of The Unabridged, The International Jew. I want to thank you for being with me, and I'll be back with you again real soon.